This is WPFP AM Park Falls, a Civic Media radio station.
You shouldn't have to sell yourself.
103.1 FM. 103.1 FM.
This week on Viewpoints.
It's everything from not being able to read a newspaper article to not being able to understand a job instruction manual or a credit card agreement or a lease agreement.
The long-term effects of never learning how to properly read. Then,
what they're basically telling us as a speaker and a listener is, hold on, I need a lot of neural activation for this.
The deeper meaning behind our uhs and ums. I'm Marty Peterson.
And I'm Gary Price. These stories in depth this week on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.
Tax Talk with Straight Talk.
You give and you give. This tax season, you get with Straight Talk Wireless. You get a reliable 5G network and unlimited data and a Samsung Galaxy A14 included when you buy an extended Silver Unlimited plan. Yeah. So you can give your janky phone to your kid. Yeah!
Switch to Straight Talk. Find us at Walmart and StraightTalk.com. For network management practices, visit StraightTalk.com. Device offer ends 4/14/24. Taxes and fees apply.
Each week on the Viewpoints Radio podcast, you'll hear from our leading experts on an important topic within education, history, society, psychology, and more.
If you can show a good money personality, one where you've got good values around how you acquire, how you use, and how you manage money, those patterns will be passed along generations.
Viewpoints Radio podcast is produced by our team of award-winning journalists. Subscribe today by searching Viewpoints Radio wherever you listen to podcasts. It's no secret that learning to read early on is a critical skill. The ability to read well and understand the information in front of you is a key part of higher level learning, getting a job, and so on. Yet, despite this, reading literacy has fallen off a cliff over the last 20 years. As of 2022, national testing showed that about 60% of U.S. children are testing below proficiency in reading. Out of this group, 40% are essentially non-readers, according to data from the Urban Institute's National Assessment of Educational Progress. In many cases, these students often never get the help they need and are pushed through and out of the system.
It is kind of a check-the-box approach, which really has not worked and explains a lot of why our reading test scores have been so dismal, with only about a third of students testing at the proficient level or above for 20 years now or more, and more than a third are testing below the basic level on national tests.
That's Natalie Wexler, an education expert and author of the book, The Knowledge Gap, The Hidden Cause of America's Broken Education System and How to Fix It. Wexler zeroes in on traditional reading comprehension curriculums, arguing that the approach is outdated and broken.
Reading comprehension has been seen by educators as a set of skills and strategies that you can just practice. It doesn't really matter what you're reading, as long as it's at your individual reading level, so you can read it pretty independently. And you're practicing skills like finding the main idea of a text or making inferences. And this goes on, this kind of practice, elementary and sometimes middle school students do it for hours every week. And the theory is that if a kid gets really good at finding the main idea of a text, that he or she will be able to apply that skill to find the main idea, understand any text, maybe a textbook down the road in high school or a passage on an end of the year reading comprehension test. But in fact, cognitive scientists have known for a long time that is actually not how reading comprehension works. What is more important than skill is how much relevant knowledge the reader has relevant to the text. And it could be knowledge of the topic, or it could be general academic knowledge and vocabulary and familiarity with the complex sentence structure of written language. And we haven't been teaching those things because we've just had kids practicing these supposed skills on really simple, easy-to-read texts.
She says that part of the problem is that there's always been a divide between education administrators and cognitive scientists studying learning. Another persistent issue is that there's no defined national curriculum. Even within one state, there can be drastic subject variation from district to district. In countries with a centralized plan, everyone's on the same page.
If you have such a curriculum, first of all, you can train teachers to teach that curriculum well before they get into the classroom. You can also ensure that all kids are getting the same knowledge, no matter what socioeconomic background they're coming from. And they're not getting, you know, Charlotte's Web 3 years in a row because teachers really like that book or whatever. They're covering in a logical, coherent way a range of topics, and everybody's getting the same information. And so that helps really to level the playing field. It's never going to entirely make up for socioeconomic differences, but we know that countries that have that kind of curriculum, there is more equity in their education systems.
Because of our disjointed approach in the U.S., many teachers are guided to cover certain niche skills that show up on national standardized tests. This scattered focus doesn't do much to actually help students in the long term.
What needs to change is what's being put in the foreground. So instead of trying to teach the skill of, and there are a bunch of them, comparing and contrasting, determining author's purpose, all of these things, instead of trying to teach that skill directly and bringing in a text to read aloud that is supposed to help kids learn that skill, and then they go off and try to practice that skill on a bunch of other different texts on random topics, choose a text, and ideally this is going to be one of a series of texts about a specific topic, and bring in whatever skills, strategies are appropriate to help students really think about and understand that text.
Reading options also need to be better tailored to a child's current reading level. While one student may be reading at an eighth grade level, another may be lagging far behind.
I saw a statistic in a study that by the time kids get to, I think it was eighth or ninth grade, the gap between the kids from the lowest socioeconomic group and the highest socioeconomic group is equivalent to about 5 years of learning. And so every year that goes by, this gap between the good readers and the poor readers actually gets wider and wider, because those good readers, and it's not that the poor readers couldn't become good readers, but they're not getting the instruction they need to become good readers. They are able to read more complex texts. They're also able to retain new vocabulary, new information from those texts, because knowledge sticks best to something that it's related to.
By the time kids get to high school, the curriculum already assumes a lot of background knowledge. By this point, it's hard to go back and lay a foundation. At the end of the day, schools need to do a better job. If you're a parent to a child and listening, Wexler offers some tips on how you can aid reading skills at home.
There is a lot that parents can do. Reading aloud, of course, reading aloud from texts that your child couldn't read on their own is really important to introduce them to that more elevated or more sophisticated vocabulary and sentence structure. And then having conversations about the text, because in order for kids to really absorb information, they need to talk about it. They need to use the vocabulary they just heard. So having those conversations is crucial. And it's not just about books. You can have conversations about rocks when you're taking a walk in the park, or insects, or whatever. So that back and forth dialogue between an adult and a child is really laying the foundation for reading comprehension in years to come.
And some people might argue that this ability isn't as important as it used to be. After all, you can Google endlessly, and there's an AI to help break down complex info. But others, including Wexler, argue that it's still a massive disadvantage.
Most of the learning that you're expected to do at upper grade levels and in college is through reading books. And if you cannot do that, you're going to be at a real disadvantage. You may be playing catch up, or you may just give up. But beyond school, there are some real life consequences of not being able to understand more complex text. And we have many, many adults in this country who are in that position. And it's everything from not being able to read a newspaper article to not being able to understand a job instruction manual or a credit card agreement or a lease agreement.
As an adult, it is possible to improve your reading proficiency. However, it's much more difficult. That's why it's so important to instill these foundational skills early on.
We're wasting this golden opportunity in these early grades because kids are so curious about all sorts of things about the world, and they are sponges. They absorb this vocabulary, and they are very proud of having that sophisticated vocabulary.
To find out more about this topic, other resources, and our guest, Natalie Wexler, head to viewpointsradio.org. For more behind the scenes and to support our show, follow us on Instagram, X, and Facebook at Viewpoints Radio. This story originally aired in October 2023 and was written by our executive producer, Ramirez Averi. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Gary Price. This segment is brought to you by Jackson Hewitt. Why are people saying hoo-yeah to Jackson Hewitt? When you switch to Jackson Hewitt, they will beat what you paid last year on tax prep, even if you filed online. Proof of prior year payment required on filing. New clients only at participating locations through April 7th. Terms at jacksonhewitt.com.
Coming up, a sociolinguist joins us to help us understand the purpose those pesky us, then you knows play in the English language when Viewpoints returns.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today? Brakes? We can save you 15% on that. We have OE quality Duralask brake pads and rotors in stock, ready for pickup or delivery. We also have calipers, brake fluid, tools, and anything else you'll need to do the job right. When you get Duralast pads and rotors together, you'll save 15%. It's just part of what makes us America's number one brakes destination.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Join Macy's and Girls Inc. Now during Women's History Month and help empower young women and girls. Throughout March, you can round up your in-store purchase to the nearest dollar or donate online to help us support Girls Inc. Since 2020, we've raised over $5.7 million to prepare 220,000 Girls Inc. participants to pursue their dreams. Give back today, shop women-owned brands, and find out how we're creating brighter futures for all at Macy's.com/purpose.
Tax Talk with Straight Talk.
You give and you give. This tax season you get with Straight Talk Wireless. You get a reliable 5G network and unlimited data and a new Samsung Galaxy A15 for just $99. So you can give your janky phone to your kid.
Yeah!
Good talk.
Switch to Straight Talk for plans starting as low as $25 a line per month for 4 lines. Find us at Walmart and StraightTalk.com. For network management practices, visit StraightTalk.com. Device offer ends 4/14/24. In-store activation on single Silver Unlimited plan or higher required. Family plan discount with 4 lines all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Taxes and fees apply.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Is your mower's battery weak or dead after winter storage? Get your mower ready for spring lawn maintenance at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Right now, purchase any SuperStart lawn and garden battery and get a $10 gift card after rebate. Choose SuperStart batteries for power, performance, and reliability exclusively at your local O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
We've all been there. It's 3 p.m. and you're sitting in a meeting room or on a Zoom call where the person presenting can't stop saying, like, you know, or another set of filler words. It can feel distracting, mind-numbing, and you might be wondering, did this person even prepare before this call? This scenario is common enough that you've likely been there yourself. Speaking in a public setting or having a difficult conversation can naturally result in more of these words pushing their way into the crevices of your sentences. Although it can be embarrassing or frustrating, these words are in fact a natural human reaction. In order to use them less, it's important to understand why they're in our vocabulary in the first place. Despite common belief, filler terms such as like that go in between words have been around for several centuries. Today, some experts are coming out in defense of these despised fillers. One of these people is sociolinguist Valerie Friedland. She argues that this style of speaking plays a specific purpose.
To help us with social signaling and to help us with communicating facts about our social identities and our experience in ways that language didn't previously. So things like and literally use non-literally that we tend to really cringe about when we hear it in young people's speech, for example, both of those came along because they were meeting needs that were unmet previously in the language, particularly for the speakers that use them.
Friedland is a professor of linguistics in the English department at the University of Nevada, Reno, and is an expert in American English and its variability across different regions of the U.S. She's also the author of the new book, Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English.
I'm a sociolinguist, which means I study the underlying principles and patterns of language, like a theoretical linguist, looking across all languages to see what they share and where they differ and what this means for how we process language and how we say sounds. But I'm particularly interested in the social angle of that. How do social facts about us change the way that we present ourselves through language and change the course of language over time?
She points to the example of the word like, which in the quoted verb means to say.
To say generally is a verbatim quote. So if I tell you what someone said, you can anticipate that that's pretty much replicating what they actually said. But to say I was like instead of I said, it indicates that maybe it's not even something you said, but how you were processing an event while it was happening or what you were thinking while it was happening. And so it gives us more flexibility in projecting thoughts, ideas, and processing over the verb to say. So as you can see, it actually met an unmet need, which the verb to say didn't offer.
Across society, certain words, such as like or have gained a bad reputation because they convey that a person is unprepared, uncertain, or feeling anxious. This language also plays into a certain social stereotype, one where the person is loosely labeled as a basic valley girl.
The valley girl stereotype that was really pervaded in the general American imagination in the 1980s was led by Frank Zappa and his daughter Moon Unit, who had that song, Valley Girl. I don't think most Americans at the time really knew about valley girls, but that song really projected them into the national consciousness. And of course, one of the features that they used really readily in that song was like, both quotative like and discourse particle like. And so I think that's when people started to notice it. And it's something called the recency illusion, that once you hear something, you hear it seemingly everywhere.
Friedland argues that like and other similar terms actually hold a deeper historical significance and are in the English language for a reason.
And like, not as a quotative verb, which is fairly recent, but like as a discourse particle. So with the ones we hear just sort of scattered in at the beginning of sentences or in the middle of sentences, things such as, like, I don't really know if I'm going to do that. Those kinds of likes, those actually have been in our language for centuries. Some of the earliest records we have of them date back to the 1700s, used in much the same way as we use them today.
Similar to like, terms such as or also play a very specific purpose. While the general public calls these filler words, Friedland says that in linguistic terms, they're referred to as discourse markers.
And are actually filled pauses or hesitation markers, and they're substantively different than things like and you know, or even discourse particles like well or so, because what they do is they seem to come as a flag for cognitive processing. And what they're basically telling us as a speaker and a listener is, hold on, I need a lot of neural activation for this. And so I'm going to pause for just a minute and come up with the more difficult, more abstract, less familiar, or less common term, or I'm going to construct a really fancy sentence syntactically. So it's going to take my brain a minute to do all that processing. And we find really interesting patterns when we look at how they're used. They're typically used before more difficult things. So when speakers are putting more effort into what they're saying by using complex, difficult words, by using larger sentences, that's when we find them to be more common.
What's the useful part of this? Shouldn't we try to speed up and be as efficient as possible? Or instead, try to replace these fillers with pauses of silence? The short answer is no. But before we get to that, it's necessary to point that these fillers shouldn't be overdone. It's definitely distracting and frustrating to the listener if there's several peppered into a conversation. It's more beneficial, on the other hand, if it's an occasional inclusion. The key is moderation. Okay, back to explaining why fillers like or are better than a pause.
It seems to flag to a listener some very, very, very important information. First, it flags that someone's taking a moment but still going to continue their turn. If they pause silently, then it might be mistaken as a turn transition cue, which would mean that the speaker is done with their turn and the listener can jump in. But if I say or it signals to the listener not only that I need a minute and I'm not done, but also, interestingly enough, how long a delay to expect. So when I it means I'm going to come right back. It's a short delay. But when I use we find that the pause that's after the is slightly longer, meaning that someone needs more time to cognitively process. So it gives really interesting cues to a listener. And by working as a flag to a listener that the speaker is doing some really intellectually deep stuff, it also prepares the listener to do heftier cognitive processing on their end. And that actually serves to help them process new information more quickly.
So the next time you're hard on yourself for all of those so's, wells, or you knows, think about why you put them in there. Could you have switched out several with a pause or breath instead? Or reset your rhythm with a sip of water? The first step to improving your articulation is by becoming more cognizant of how you speak. To find out more about this topic and our guest Valerie Friedland, visit viewpointsradio.org. Also, check out her book, Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English, now available in select bookstores and online. For more behind the scenes, search Viewpoints Radio on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. This segment was written by our executive producer, Amira Zaveri. Studio production by Jason Dickey. I'm Marty Peterson.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment. Each week on the Viewpoints Radio podcast, you'll hear from our leading experts on an important topic within education, history, society, psychology, and more.
If you can show a good money personality, one where you've got good values around how you acquire, how you use, and how you manage money, those patterns will be passed along generations.
Viewpoints Radio podcast is produced by our team of award-winning journalists. Subscribe today by searching Viewpoints Radio wherever you listen to podcasts.
Tax Talk with Straight Talk.
You give and you give. This tax season you get with Straight Talk Wireless. You get a reliable 5G network and unlimited data and a Samsung Galaxy A14 included when you buy an extended Silver Unlimited plan. Yeah! So you can give your janky phone to your kid.
Yeah! Switch to Straight Talk. Find us at Walmart and StraightTalk.com. For network management practices, visit StraightTalk.com. Device offer ends 4/14/24. Taxes and fees apply.
This is Viewpoints Explained. I'm Ebony McMorris. How often do you exercise? 2, 3, or even 5 times a week? Maybe the number is zero when you like to get back into the gym. Today, fewer than 25% of Americans meet the minimum guidelines for physical activity. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends everyone get about 2.5 hours per week of moderate exercise, like biking, walking, or tennis. If you're doing a vigorous activity like running or swimming laps, the number falls to 1 hour and 15 minutes per week. On top of that, the CDC also recommends at least 2 days of muscle strengthening exercises like lifting weights, Pilates, or uphill walking. Historically, women have lagged behind men when it comes to meeting these standards. Now, a new study published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology asks whether these one-size-fits-all requirements could be better tailored to different sexes. The study analyzed exercise data from 400,000 people. Researchers found that only about 1 in 5 women do strength training exercises 2 to 3 days a week. However, this group in particular had a 30% reduction in cardiovascular death. The study concluded that for women in particular, regular weight training extended life expectancy and decreased the risk of premature death from heart disease. More research is needed to confirm the study's results, but in the meantime, it might be worthwhile to invest in a new set of weights. That's Viewpoints Explained for this week. More in a moment.
Welcome to Culture Crash, where we examine what's new and old in entertainment. Now that award season is fully behind us and Dune Part 2 has been out for a while, many film enthusiasts are nervously wondering what comes next. Because of the prolonged strikes that shut down Hollywood last year, there's a worry about a lack of compelling titles at your local theater in 2024. But I'm not so sure that's what's going to happen, because already this year I've been surprised by a movie I wasn't heavily anticipating but ended up loving, called Love Lies Bleeding. The Kristen Stewart starring film is the second movie from writer-director Rose Glass, who is also behind the 2019 film St. Maud. Love Lies Bleeding is a genre-bending romantic crime thriller that tells the story of a gym manager and a bodybuilder who fall in love in 1989. The movie harkens back to crime thrillers like Blood Simple and Bound. Mixing love, crime, and a heavy dose of body horror, Love Lies Bleeding is just the first of many sleeper candidates to become personal favorites this year. In April alone, there are several movies I'm looking forward to. First up will be Monkey Man, a revenge action thriller from Dev Patel that's being compared to John Wick, about a fighter in Mumbai who takes his vengeance on corruption, and that movie is set for release on April 5th. On April 12th, audiences will get to see Civil War, the next movie from Alex Garland starring Kirsten Dunst about a future dystopian America that's broken into a second civil war. On April 26th, we'll get to see Challengers, a love triangle romance movie set in the world of tennis from director Luca Guadagnino and starring Zendaya. In May, we'll see The Fall Guy starring Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, then a new Planet of the Apes movie, then Furiosa, the next installment in George Miller's Mad Max saga. In June, a sequel to Inside Out will hit theaters, followed by a prequel in the A Quiet Place universe. I could go on and on, but the point is this. 2023 was a great year for movies, and 2024 was feared to be a slowdown. But now that the year's underway, we're seeing plenty of evidence that actually there's a lot to look forward to at your local Cineplex. Just don't forget the popcorn. I'm Evan Ruck.
It's game day at Jim's house, and the spread is impressive.
Mike's already done some damage with the hot wings, and now he's dropping back and going deep for another slice of pizza.
I sure hope he brought the Pepto.
Mike knows the Pepto-Bismol provides fast, five-symptom relief from unexpected stomach upsets. He's no rookie.
The way he's throwing back those nachos, he's the GOAT.
Be ready for game day with Pepto-Bismol.
When you have nausea, heartburn, indigestion, upset stomach, diarrhea.
Use as directed. Keep out of reach of children.
Join Macy's and Girls, Inc. Now Dream Women's History Month and help empower young women and girls. Throughout March, you can round up your in-store purchase to the nearest dollar or donate online to help us support Girls, Inc. Since 2020, we've raised over $5.7 million to prepare 220,000 Girls, Inc. participants to pursue their dreams. Give back today, shop women-owned brands, and find out how we're creating brighter futures for all at Macy's.com/purpose.
That's Viewpoints for this week. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming shows and find a library of past programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and more information about our guests at viewpointsradio.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Viewpoints.
You're listening to Radio Health Journal, the trusted news source for medicine, science, and technology. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
I'm Shel Lustig.
And I'm Greg Johnson. This week, are we entering an era of psychedelic therapy?
Like a major class of drugs was made illegal back in the 1960s. And now we have the opportunity to bring that class of drug back in a careful way.
But first, is the cancer drug shortage a result of industry greed?
It's a generic drug and there's not much money to be made. And I mean, I thought it was pretty irrelevant that people aren't making enough money on saving my life.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
Tax Talk with Straight Talk.
You give and you give. This tax season you get with Straight Talk Wireless. You get a reliable 5G network and unlimited data and a Samsung Galaxy A14 included when you buy an extended Silver Unlimited plan. Yeah! So you can give your janky phone to your kid. Yeah!
Switch to Straight Talk. Find us at Walmart and StraightTalk.com. For network management practices, visit StraightTalk.com. Device offer ends 4/14/24. Taxes and fees apply.
Is switching your wireless service to Total by Verizon easy?
Totalmente.
And you get unlimited 5G data? $25 a line for 4 lines on the unlimited plan? At an amazing price? With no contracts. Should you switch to Total by Verizon? Definitely. Totalmente. Find a store or switch Suavemente at TotalByVerizon.com. Monthly rate when you activate without a pay, plus taxes and fees. Discount begins the month after you enroll. Additional terms apply. See website for data management practices.
Barbara Barnett lives in Spartanburg, South Carolina, a town with lush parks and a regional history museum that boasts about its rich past of textile mills and railroads. But this Hallmark-worthy life was recently threatened when Barnett was diagnosed with cancer.
There's probably not many other bits of news you can receive that is more devastating than your physician saying that you have cancer. There's a lot going on. You're thinking about financial issues. You're thinking about your mortality. You're thinking about your kids. And that's a whole lot to have on your shoulders.
Barnett's had two rounds of chemotherapy since March of 2023. After the first few treatment sessions, she says the process became somewhat routine, even if it was still terrifying. But when she saw her doctor to schedule the next appointment, he wasn't able to give her a date. Instead, he had to break the news that Barnett's chemotherapy drugs were experiencing a shortage, and he'd have to cut her usual dose in half.
When they told me that, it was so hard for them and, of course, hard for me, and I was really stunned. And so what I did was I just got on the computer, and I started kind of bashing everyone from the senators to anybody that had anything to do with, you know, the shortage, and found out that apparently, I don't know, it's a generic drug and there's not much money to be made and all these kind of things I really didn't want to hear about. You know, I mean, I thought it was pretty irrelevant that people aren't making enough money on saving my life.
Though it began to affect Barnett during the summer of 2023, the shortage stemmed from a problem in 2022. A raw materials production facility in India failed a surprise FDA inspection toward the end of that year. They chose to shut down and fix their quality issues. As an unforeseen consequence, the American Cancer Society reports that it halted almost half of all cisplatin and methotrexate production for the U.S. Both are widely used cancer medications. Dr. Julie Grelow says we couldn't have known just how large the repercussions would be.
We did not understand, because we don't, you know, have access to who uses raw materials from where, et cetera. We didn't understand how much of the raw materials were supplying all of the manufacturers, essentially. So when one raw material plant got shut down, it impacted the four or five manufacturers, and all of a sudden, we're in short supply.
Grelow, the chief medical officer at the American Society of Clinical Oncology, says cancer drug shortages have been a problem for more than a decade. But when demand spiked for alternative options, we began to see a shortage for another chemotherapy drug called carboplatin as well.
They're chemotherapy drugs that are given by injection into the vein that treat lots of common cancers, including breast cancer, lung cancer, and colon cancer. And we've estimated that the shortage this past year could have affected up to 500,000 people in the United States.
Suddenly, doctors were having to choose between patients, who needed to stay on their current treatment plan and who could hopefully afford to have their dose cut in half or changed altogether.
It's like I couldn't even really complain, because he said, we've got to share it with the other patients. And you're like, well, I can't complain about that, because I want everybody to be healthy. It was so hard for them to tell me this information. These nurses are just angels on earth, and it was so hard for them, because I guess they've been doing it all day or all week or whatever in terms of not giving the patients the needed medications, and that's just not in their wheelhouse to be able to deal with that. I don't know how you sit and look at someone and say, well, we can't give it to you, but we've got to give it to someone else.
The main question in all of this chaos is why? In our modern day of technology and innovation, what could possibly be causing such a devastating shortage? Grelow says it can be traced back to the economics of how these drugs are made.
So the drugs that go into shortage are not the expensive ones that are still on patent that you hear about for $10,000 to $20,000 a dose. These are the old drugs. They're generic and off patent. They are tried and true. And they, when the drug goes off patent, then manufacturers around the world can jump into the market, get approval, compete, drive the price down, drive it so low that, for example, U.S. manufacturers say we can't make it for that low price. We're getting out of the market. We'll focus on other things.
Instead, manufacturers in countries like China and India step in.
They're making a very, very narrow margin. They might not invest as much in kind of the manufacturing line and all. And so they're more vulnerable.
In oncology, most of our issues really derive from the supply side. That being that the supplies are very, very tight and there's little redundancy or resilience in those manufacturing chains. So any disruption whatsoever, whether that be from a natural disaster or from a plant shutting down for maintenance, economic reasons, quality reasons, et cetera, it really ripples through the whole supply chain.
That's Mark Fleury, a policy principal with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. He says that these shortage issues stem from the cheap prices that Grelo mentioned earlier.
Generics are designed to be low cost. The introduction of competition drives price down, and we want that. But we think in some of these cases, the prices may be driven down so low that manufacturers are exiting the market, or those that are staying in the market really have no extra margin to invest in facility upgrades or resilient manufacturing or even things like stockpiles. So I think long term, we think that the economic situation needs to change and there needs to be a sustainable market for generic sterile injectables that can reward resilient and redundant supplies. But as much as we've had concerns about high drug prices, the irony here is that in this particular sector, these generic sterile injectables, we may have gone too far the other direction and made it too low. These facilities just don't have any extra money to go over and above the bare minimum to keep these sites operational.
Grelo says various bills have recently been introduced before Congress that address the economic hurdles. Others focus on improving communication between manufacturers, the FDA, and medical providers when a shortage is occurring. Another proposal looks at increasing the FDA's visibility into the supply chain. But Fleury is skeptical that it will have a meaningful impact.
A lot of what we've charged FDA to do is what I would refer to as crisis management. By the time the FDA gets involved, it's because there's already an issue that's affecting patients, or they can see this wave, if you will, coming on the horizon that's going to affect patients shortly if they don't do something. But all of that is sort of crisis management. So they're responding to problems that exist. And better visibility helps them maybe see the crisis coming sooner or helps them address it a little bit better, but it doesn't affect the root cause of the crisis.
So while improving the tools they have could help, it still will always be focused on crisis management. Fleury says we have to look at the larger ecosystem instead of hyper-fixating on one aspect of the issue.
I mean, I've been working in this field for over a decade, and every couple of years, we're spending time on addressing drug shortages. And historically, it's always been about sort of cranking up the transparency and the ability to see things, but we've not addressed sort of the underlying root cause.
But long-term solutions take time to figure out, time that cancer patients affected by the shortage today don't have. So while Fleury thinks increasing the FDA's visibility is just a short-term fix, it may be the one that could quickly help patients.
These drugs are made with what we call active pharmaceutical ingredients, or API. So while FDA has visibility into the finished drug product, what you or I would buy at the pharmacy, they don't really have visibility to the raw ingredients which go into it. And sometimes we're seeing shortages of those raw ingredients which ripple through. And so that's an example of one place where I think visibility could be improved.
We need to be able to see the data of what manufacturers are getting their raw materials from where, et cetera, so we can better anticipate if we shut down one plant in India, how much of an impact that's going to have in the U.S.
In this case, that impact has been overwhelming.
First, you have all of the stress and fear created by a new cancer diagnosis, and then you get started on your chemotherapy, and you know, you get your first dose or two, maybe you've adjusted, figured out how to manage the side effects, and then all of a sudden you're told for your next dose, we don't have one of the drugs, we're going to have to change a plan. Just think of how much stress and fear that would cause.
When Barnett went in to get her half dose of chemo, she was told they were completely out of carboplatin. The doctor changed her treatment plan to only use one drug instead of the dual dosages. But Barnett was left worrying if this alteration would be less effective.
The disease is already overwhelming. I mean, I don't even read, you know, things on Google because of how hard it is to look at the statistics and all that stuff. And I just feel like I'm not going to be a statistic and I'm going to, you know, eat well and exercise and do the best I can. But when my healthcare system can't even give me what I need, that's the very least I should have to worry about.
Barnett was eventually able to continue with her original treatment plan, but the sigh of relief was short-lived. Who's to say this won't happen again? Despite the supply chain issues and economic obstacles, at the end of the day, these are real people with very serious diseases who rely on this medication to live. And now, people like Barnett have the added stress of wondering if their next appointment will end early, yet again, because they don't have enough drugs for everyone. You can find more information about Barbara Barnett, Mark Fleury, and Dr. Julie Graylow on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
Coming up, will ketamine bring about a new drug crisis? When Radio Health Journal returns.
Join Macy's and Girls Inc. Now during Women's History Month and help empower young women and girls. Throughout March, you can round up your in-store purchase to the nearest dollar or donate online to help us support Girls Inc. Since 2020, we've raised over $5.7 million to prepare 220,000 Girls Inc. participants to pursue their dreams. Give back today, shop women-owned brands, and find out how we're creating brighter futures for all at Macy's.com/purpose.
Is switching your wireless service to Total by Verizon easy?
Totalmente.
And you get unlimited 5G data? $25 a line for 4 lines on the unlimited plan? At an amazing price? With no contracts. Should you switch to Total by Verizon? Definitely.
Totalmente.
Find a store or switch suavemente at totalbyverizon.com. Monthly rate when you activate without a pay, plus taxes and fees. Discount begins the month after you enroll. Additional terms apply. See website for data management practices.
Psychedelic therapies have been showing promising results in recent years. However, Dr. Howard Kornfeld says we need to tread carefully into this new age of medicine. Even well-known substances like ketamine should be handled delicately. While it's having a renaissance at the moment, ketamine has been around for years. It was developed just before the Vietnam War as a general anesthetic drug.
It was found to be a very safe way to put people who were on the battlefield or who were out somewhere where there wasn't a hospital, to give them a shot. And then they went into a state where you could do surgery on them or save their lives. It was found to be a very, very useful drug in acute care medicine.
Kornfeld, a specialist in pain and addiction medicine, says a main advantage of using ketamine was that it didn't stop the patient's breathing or lower their blood pressure. After its success on the battlefield, ketamine was FDA approved in 1970 as an anesthetic. Suddenly, people who couldn't find any relief for their chronic pain conditions felt better after being given an IV drip of the drug. But the benefits didn't end there. The first clinical research for using ketamine as a treatment for depression was in 2000. The paper revealed that this drug could significantly improve depressive symptoms within 72 hours. As word of this fast-acting antidepressant treatment spread, ketamine clinics began to pop up all over the country.
And then people realized that if they gave the ketamine as a shot, you know, an injection, that the blood level went up kind of high and then went down. And during that high, people did have a mini psychedelic experience. So all of a sudden, like, psychedelics were in, and then there was this one legal drug that could act like a psychedelic.
Kornfeld himself began using ketamine therapy in a rehab facility he founded called Recovery Without Walls. He offers it to patients as a supplement to their ongoing treatment plan for addiction or pain management. The process starts with a few psychotherapy sessions. Then, when the time comes, the patient lays down in a dark, quiet room that's designed for them to feel as comfortable as possible with a therapist present to guide them.
And so the patient really feels safe, and sometimes